Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the All Good in the Brotherhood podcast, the podcast of the Benedict Project. My name is Brother Francisco Whitaker, Benedictine monk and deacon of St. Vincent Archabbey in Latrobe, Pennsylvania. And I am joined by my fellow deacon and seminary classmate from the Diocese of Ogdensburg, New York, Tyler Fitzgerald. So,
thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. And let's just paint a picture of Ogdensburg, New York, because until I met him, I didn't even know it existed. I've heard of, you know, obviously the Archdiocese of New York and Diocese of Buffalo and Syracuse, but yeah, what and where is Ogdensburg?
That is a frequently asked question. So imagine a picture of New York State. We are the top cap, encompassing just above Syracuse, east along the whole Adirondack mountain range, on the eastern side along the Champlain Valley, the entire St. Lawrence River into the Thousand Islands. Yes, where the salad dressing comes from.
There you go. Which I have been in that the Thousand Island region, I think they call it, right? We did a boat tour when I was in like middle school with my grandparents. And I camped in the Adirondacks. But I had no idea that this was its own diocese. And your cathedral is pretty small, isn't it?
Actually, the seating, it's about, I believe, 1,500.
Oh, wow. Okay.
We were once, 60 years ago, in the 60s, we had 266 priests and about 120-something parishes. We were bustling. At one point, believe it or not, there was more shipping through Ogdensburg, New York, than there was through Detroit, Michigan.
Wow.
Huge industry area.
That's crazy. And now, though.
It's a little different. No, mostly a tourist area, the Thousand Islands, the Adirondacks.
Yeah, right.
It makes ministry unique, but challenging.
Well, let's talk about that then. So the reason I wanted to have, we call him Fitz here in the seminary, so I'll just probably call him that the rest of the episode. But the reason I wanted to have Fitz on was we were both ordained deacons this past, was same day.
The same day.
Right? Yeah.
You were an hour ahead of me, though.
Yeah.
You've been a deacon an hour longer than me.
And I'll hold that over him. And you know, I will be ordained a priest a week ahead of him. So I'm so much holier.
Whatever. You know? Just ordain me. It's been 8 years too long.
Yeah, you did high school seminary, right?
I'm the only seminarian at St. Vincent Seminary. Well, not anymore. I can't say that. There's some new guys that came in this year, but one of the only that entered out of high school.
That's crazy.
This is my 8th year of seminary.
Oof.
Yeah. And the only cleric in Ogdensburg, New York, born in the 21st century.
Wow, that's a fun fact.
Yeah. Yeah, the future.
Because you were born in 2000?
2000.
That's crazy. Yeah, wow. Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, the future is here. The
future is here. Yeah.
You are the face of the 21st century for your diocese. That is scary. Yeah, because even Ken Kevin, was born in what,
97.
97, yeah. So yeah. Even after he's ordained, you still will be.
Yeah.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyways, what I wanted to have Fitz on to talk about was, since we're both ordained deacons, we've been now transitional deacons for almost 6 months, which is wild.
Wow. I know. It's November.
Yeah. So which means we're also only about 6 months away from our priestly ordination. So kind of just to talk about what it's been like being a deacon. So you've experienced both like a whole summer of diaconate ministry in your diocese, but then something at St. Vincent, and I think this is pretty common in most seminaries, but deacons are assigned to a parish in a diocese for pretty much the whole academic year. Mm-hmm. And the way we do it is we travel to it on the weekends. Do you leave on Friday as well or Saturday?
Depends what's going on, but typically Fridays or Saturday.
Okay, yeah. So late Friday, early Saturday, go to the parish. And for both of us, it's in the Pittsburgh Diocese. We're actually, our parishes aren't too far apart. They're like 20 minutes. So I'm in Upper St. Clair, St. Catherine Laboureux, and you're in...
Well,
this whole...
It's the most Ogdensburg-esque of all the Pittsburgh parishes. Yeah. We have 6 churches. The parish is Isidore the Farmer, based in Imperial, Pennsylvania. Our farthest western, on the western side of the parish, in Avella, Pennsylvania, is only about a half an hour from Steubenville, Ohio. So it gives you a sense of basically West Virginia.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, an hour and 40 minutes from the seminary.
Yeah, you probably have the longest drive.
I think I do.
Mine's about 75 minutes.
I could go through the city. but I'm not a city boy, and I refuse to do Pittsburgh driving Friday at 3 o'clock.
No, I mean you would be
So
way it would be way longer than an hour and
I
40.
go all the way around Washington and straight
Okay.
up
Yeah,
that way.
that's what I would do too. So anyways, so between both of that and then your work in your summer parish, which you were in a Thousand Island parish, right?
No, the
Or
last 2 summers was in the Thousand Islands.
okay.
Beautiful. Big fan. This past summer, I was actually, it gives you an idea of how northern we are. I was an hour south from downtown Montreal.
Oh wow, okay. So
Montreal to us Americans, but to the Quebecois, Montreal. Historically, a very, very, very French Catholic area of the diocese. Number of priests with very French names still live there, but it's dying. I had one communion call a week. I could use French.
Wow,
And
wow.
I learned Parisian French in high school, but the Quebecois accent, there's a dialect in Quebec and Montreal called Jardin, and this lady speaks more Jardin. So I could get the gist. But the sad thing is she has early Alzheimer's.
Oh man.
And I'd walk in and I'd say, Bonjour, madame, je suis de Diacre. And then she would just switch into French.
Oh boy.
And her daughters were confused and really, really worried she wouldn't go back to English because she'll wake up middle of the
That's
night
crazy.
screaming French and praying in French.
Wow.
So I was able to, give her the blessing in French and pray the Notre Père and give communion in French to a woman with early Alzheimer's that's forgetting English.
Wow. I don't think I knew that.
No?
That's crazy. I can't imagine like your mom waking up and screaming in another language.
Yeah, and it's from that era where she grew up, the household language was French, but her parents wanted her to learn English because there was this weird shift in the sort of the World War II era of we want to be American. They kind of forgot the identity of, well, what does it mean to be American? They really forgot their customs. It's not somewhere like Chicago or even New York where you have huge Polish pockets that still speak Polish or Italian in New York City. We really forgot the cultural ethnic identity up there. We just gave up on the languages. In fact, when I was in the Thousand Islands, one of the priests I was assigned with, both of them actually, their first language was French. That's a
Wow.
reality that just isn't the same anymore.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. You think now, especially in Pittsburgh, we have members of our community here at the seminary that they're learning English to minister over here.
Yeah, right.
We had to teach once upon a time guys to learn English because their first language was French. And then one more fun fact, one of the priests, a native French speaker, was assigned to a couple years ago. He never heard of a Protestant before he came to America. He was from Old Quebec, and his little village
They were
in the
all.
old city, Protestants, it was not a thing.
There
He
was
did
just all
not
Catholic.
know there were
Wow.
he didn't know that Protestants existed.
That's
How far have we come from
No
that?
kidding. Yeah. They're everywhere.
So anyway, I know I wasn't in the Thousand Islands this past summer. I still have great connections. In fact, some parishioners from there just traveled 10 hours to see me for the weekend.
Yeah, that's
I visit,
dedication.
lead holy hours, communion services. I just love being there. My heart is in the Thousand Islands for sure. But I was on the eastern side of the diocese, which I have very little experience with before this summer. Once a very, very rich, culturally French Canadian area, really impoverished now. And one of the things I did was there's a religious sister, and she's very devoted to her communion calls. And I think we saw probably 30 or 40 people a week. And in fact, well, so right now in the seminary, we're in self-evaluation season.
Oh, our favorite.
Yes.
Love it.
After this, I have to go finish mine. It's due in like what, 8 hours? It's not done yet. And one of the calls I went on, you pull up to this sketch trailer. Very, very sad. It looks almost abandoned. And sister said, Deacon, just be aware. The daughter's a little, you don't know how she's gonna react. You knock on the door where she sees you. Okay. Knock on the door, so we go in, everything's fine. And then straight ahead by the door is this little old lady, kind of all matted, tangled, dirty gray hair, sitting on garbage
Ugh.
in an old, beaten up, nasty recliner, garbage all around her. The grandson, who is in and out of prison for drug dealing and troubles with the law, just scurrying around the house. There's pizza all over the floor, cat food. There's like a cat half dead, lying on the front porch. I had to step over to get into that trailer. Just sheer poverty, and just a very sad situation. And then here I am with the, you know, I had the picks around a burse around my neck, and just having the Blessed Sacrament there with me, and then opening it and holding the Eucharist in this situation. You know, I'm staring at the host, but also, you know, staring at her through the host, essentially. And just all around me, just filth. And knowing that in that moment, that is the most beautiful thing that that woman will encounter today.
Wow.
Is the Eucharist. It's divine love in the midst of all that chaos.
And I mean, that's, I mean, that's what Jesus was born into, and that's what he ministered to when he went into the you know, the homes of the sinners and tax collectors, right? Wow, yeah, that, and you'll remember that, yeah. You know, you'll remember
It sticks with me. In fact, that takes up a good, almost a full page of my self-evaluation.
Really?
Just reflecting on this profound experience of, wow, like, this is truly encountering human suffering and poverty. And yet this lady is all excited to receive the Eucharist, and just, she couldn't care. She didn't care that her house was a dump and that her drug addict grandson is off the walls. She just wanted the Eucharist. And like, Lord, if I had that faith every day.
Yeah. Wow. No kidding.
Be a lot easier.
Well, I'm my parish.
Oh, wow.
Is in
how,
like,
the turntables.
Polar opposite of that. So Upper St. Clair, if anyone is familiar with the South Hills of Pittsburgh, is a fairly affluent area, not quite. So my parish is called St. Catherine Labouré. It was a grouping between two churches, which it still is. The other one, so there's two, St. Louis de Marillac, which is where all of the masses and everything is at this point. And St. Joan of Arc, which is only about, 5 miles away, which has closed and is only really open for funerals and weddings and baptisms. And even that is kind of starting to go away. But the joke is that the name of the church, instead of St. Louis de Marillac, should be St. Louis de Cadillac. And there's another church in the South Hills Village, which is pretty close to where I am. It's not in my grouping, but... is called St. Thomas More, and I don't know if you heard the nickname for that one, but no. It's St. Thomas We Have More.
I haven't heard the Cadillac and
yeah. More. So anyways, my experience has been the complete opposite of walking into a trailer filled with trash. It's walking into million-dollar homes to have dinner with people. And, you know, and first and foremost, like, both need Christ just as desperately, because both groups of people have such a need to have Jesus fill our souls. Yet what a very different challenge it is to convince both of those people about their need for Jesus. I think one in poverty, and maybe you can speak to this a little bit, but almost feels like when you have nothing, I have nothing to offer Jesus, like, what could Jesus want with me? Versus the other half, like, I have everything. What do I need of Jesus? What would I want of Jesus? And both can deprive themselves of grace. And I know my pastor has said one of the hardest challenges he's had when he came in is to convince people that you, in fact, do need God. Like, people, you know, they're driving, you know, we have Corvettes and Mercedes in our parking lots. It's just a really rich area. And, you know, these people are doctors and lawyers and prosecuting attorneys. You know, they're very successful. And he said to show them, and they're comfortable. And I think kind of a difficulty, you know, with successful life is, there are people who, you know, it causes them to go crazy, or they lose everything, or they start into affairs or gambling or whatever. But when you don't, when you're just like a generally okay person and you're just also rich, you're kind of comfy and like, nothing really is a struggle. And why do I need God if I don't have struggle? And my life seems pretty okay. So I know one of the themes of my homilies that I've talked about in the past a lot is pride, of the belief that we really don't need God, or don't need God as much as we're told we need him. I had a homily last month that was on complacency, and that's like the greatest trap in the spiritual life. And we actually have a podcast episode that was my basically sharing that homily, so I won't repeat it. But how complacency leads to an acedia in the spiritual life. And last weekend I preached on ego, and which for me stands as edging God out. Where are we moving? What place have we said, I'm going to reclaim this territory? I'm going to reassert my dominance here. And wherever we edge God out, we will become the place in which we establish ourselves as our own God. And in that situation, that's what those people need to hear. Not all, I'm not painting a picture where like all of these are, rich snobs who don't believe in Jesus. Like, there is great faith in my parish, mm-hmm. and it's thriving. The young families, young life, it's wonderful. It's mm-hmm. amazing. They are truly in love with Jesus. And yet, we also, no matter how much in love we are with Jesus, can always fall more in love with him, mm-hmm. And those reminders. So, how did you preach to that community versus like the Thousand Islands, which the tourist millionaires literally who come for the summer?
It was, you have to preach differently. You just, it's a reality. And even in the Thousand Islands, there are, I'll say normal, just kind of middle-class people. The summers I was there, sure, there was a day I was, it was 4th of July, watching fireworks in a literal $2 million penthouse on the water.
Yeah, right.
But the next day I was at someone's family farm picking blackberries and strawberries, and their cat was laying on my feet and the dog was licking me. Mm. And I was over there holding little baby chicks in my hand, playing with the chicks on the farm. That's all within a 20-mile radius of extreme wealth and tourist vacation land. But also there are people that live there year-round. So how do you have a balance of preaching to them? And then the same thing too for weddings. Mm-hmm. I'm sure we had a class yesterday, and the reality in my diocese is weddings are just not that common anymore. The Thousand Islands is a huge destination wedding place. And I don't know, I think in the past couple of years, only one parishioner that actually got married.
Wow.
The rest are all destination from as far as Texas and all over New York State coming to the Thousand Islands to get married. They want the hotel. They want the river view.
Yeah.
Like, oh, the church here is nice, so let's do that. I called it my tourist ministry. How do you minister to people that are just passing in that area for a day, a week, a summer? So I was very present on the street. I'd go to community events. I wasn't ordained yet, so I wasn't in clerics, but if I was assigned there again, I'd absolutely be walking the streets in clerics, introducing myself and saying, come to St. Mary's, we have air conditioning. It's hot out today. Come to the air conditioned church. And deep down, I do believe that my diocese, especially the Thousand Islands and the Adirondacks, almost, if you're familiar with the story of how Steubenville has exploded, there's nothing going on there. I know very little about it. My best friend is from Steubenville. I kind of get the gist of how there's a group that stuck with it.
Yeah.
They're like, we're going to do this Catholic thing. We're going to live here and we're going to do it, darn it. And now look what's happening. I do believe that my home could be like that. We have natural beauty. You've been to the Adirondacks, the Thousand Islands. If we made this of a place of encounter with natural beauty and meeting God in that, we could thrive. Mm-hmm. Imagine if, you go there for vacation for the scenery. Imagine going there for vacation because there's beautiful liturgy.
Wow.
Yeah. And the priests are on fire.
Mm.
And there's youth. Something I struggle with is we have youth in the diocese at home. They go to Christendom. They go to Franciscan. I don't think we've even gone to St. Vincent yet. But they go to these Catholic hubs and they don't come home. They stay.
Mm.
And I see that almost as maybe a little bit of sloth or just staying in the comfort zone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They don't want to take this home and spread it. You flee what we call the North Country because it's impoverished and dying. Industry is gone. The churches are closing. The faith is dying. But you're fueling the problem. You are part of the problem.
Mm.
Come back and be on fire.
Yeah.
okay, you're not going to get a six-figure job right away. Suck it up, offer it up. Just let's build a Catholic community. I'm very passionate about this because we once had it. We had cloistered Carmelites in the mountains. Mm. We had, if you know, the White Friars of Africa.
Yeah, yeah.
They were in the Thousand Islands in Hawke's Bay. Mm. They're friends. We had hundreds of Franciscans in Croghan, New York. Huge monastery and friary. We did it once. Our diocesan seminary closed about 20 years ago. And we fueled priests, college seminarians for all of New York State and a lot of Canadian dioceses. The potential is there. Which is my preaching theme at home is always beauty and looking to the past. I love history, but not clinging to it and worshiping it as an idol.
Yeah.
We did it once. We can do this again. We just need young faithful Catholics and priests to step up and full steam ahead, go with it. But it's very hard when they go experience places like Franciscan, Christendom, St. Vincent, and they stay there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something, you know, I've been working in campus ministry now for 5.5 years, and I continually remind the students that, like, their time in campus ministry in college is a very, it might feel like a long time, but it's a very short experience of their life, and that everything they're learning on all the community they're building here is meant to then be taken back to their home parishes. I remind them all the time, like, you're going to have a home parish, and you got to do these things there. And you will probably be one of the only people who will do these things.
Yeah.
So God has called you here, not to keep you here. As you know, one of our professors, Dr. Poharik, says all the time, like, we come in to be sent out, to gather more, to come back, which I talked about in the last episode actually too. That's a hard thing to also keep, like, energy about preaching, when especially when it looks like it might not get anywhere for a while, but just to keep it up. But I have some questions. I know we've been kind of going off, which has been great. So I'll kind of put these two together. What has been your favorite part, and what has been a challenging part of being a deacon these past 6-ish months?
Favorite part, hands down, baptisms.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
I've been so blessed.
Let's hear it. How many of you have done it at this point? Wow.
Six baptisms. My first two were in the Thousand Islands. Nice little providential. You know, where I fell in love with my vocation was on those two summer assignments. And, you know, baptizing on the banks of the mighty St. Lawrence, just a whole. We could pray with that for days. I love baptisms. I'm a huge liturgy and history nerd. So I love catechizing about the sacrament. Mm-hmm. I'll explain, okay, what's so special about water? I'm trying to lead them to say, you know, everything living needs water. Is it also dangerous? Well, yeah, you can drown in water. Mm-hmm. You don't want to get water in your engine or your electrical system. So water is life-giving. It's also a death, right? So then I explain birth and death and work it in. And then I always explain oil and water and fire. This is all from the earth.
Yeah.
So our sacramentology is we take things of creation, we offer it to God, and we elevate it for his worship and to draw us into the Paschal mystery, to draw us into divinity. So I always love teaching as I go about the water and the oil.
That's great.
And the best moment, last month I had a baptism at St. Colmkill in Imperial, Pennsylvania. And I was talking to the parents beforehand, and the mother's name was some robust Italian name. And the little jar for the oil of the catechumen was weird. It was like low. So like I was trying to like dip my thumb and get oil. I got like oil all over my hand here. So I go to anoint the kid's breast there. And that tongue just shot out. It started licking the oil off my fingers. And I'm like, they don't teach this in seminary. And without even thinking, it's just kind of my goofball personality. I was like, he's Italian, and the family loved it. So there's a baby licking the oil of the catechumen off my fingers, and he was just loving it. He was so content, even pouring the water. He was just like, looking up. I just love baptism. Mm-hmm. It's so life-giving for me. I come from a small family. I don't have nieces and nephews. I'm the oldest grandson from my grandparents. So I don't have friends with kids, so I really I love children. I love being with children, but I don't encounter them too often at home, especially. So I love baptisms. Something I did is two things. I always get a picture holding the kid. And if they're tall enough, I'll wrap the cope around them and they're holding the candle. And then I started writing all their names in the front of my ritual book so that I can pray for them, realize that I'm a spiritual father. I may never see them on earth again.
Yeah.
I probably never will. But I can pray for them and know that, you know, I can see them in heaven someday. I'm the one that started this whole sacramental life for them. And I'm devoted to my own baptismal feast day, Teresa of Avila, October 15th. And this, I call him, you know, his little rapid fire tongueling up of the oil. It was within the octave of my own baptism.
Oh, wow.
So just a beautiful moment to really share baptismal grace with him and renew my own baptismal promises in that. The challenge is I don't do change well.
Okay.
I don't do change well. Mm. So going from the day-to-day go, 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 you know, you can relate to this. Our Mondays, we are literally in the classroom, 8:30 to 3:45.
Yeah, it's misery. After having been at the parish for the whole weekend.
Yes. There's much recreation and cocktail sharing Monday nights, typically. But I don't do change very well. And going from weekend, really the leash is off. My pastor's saying, okay, I can't make it to dinner. Here's money. Go get dinner or do whatever you want. I'm not around. It's liberating. It's exciting. I can do the ministry I want. I can do what I want. I can relax if I want to relax. I can go for a walk if I want to go for a walk. To be thrown back into seminary reality of everything is...
Yeah. Back in the fishbowl.
And it's something that I don't know if other seminaries do this. I don't think so. Once a semester, the deacons don't have academic classes for 2 weeks. We're in our parish for 14 days, essentially, plus the weekends. So coming back from that, you want to talk about whiplash?
Yeah, no kidding.
Holy cow. So that's the biggest challenge for me as a deacon right now is being present to both communities and not neglecting them. Because I'm still called to be in the seminary. Eight years and counting, baby. But I can't give up on it.
Yeah.
Because the Lord wants me here right now. It's hard. It's hard. But if I don't believe that, then I can't also believe that he entrusted me with a parish community right now as well. Mm-hmm. So baptism's favorite part. Having to come back to seminary Sunday nights late after youth group. Monday morning hits hard.
Yeah. No, I know, dude. Yeah, I come back late from youth group too. And when I'm driving back, I'm like, oh, do I have to do this? Can I stay? I've had two baptisms. I have another coming up this weekend, and I think another the weekend after that. And my very first one was such a joy because I got a text from my pastor, I think like Wednesday or Thursday of that week. He just said like, hey, we got a baptism coming up this Sunday. I figured, you know, you want some practice. Would you like to do it? And I'm like, yeah, sure. He goes, great. It's at 1:15. And that's all I got.
That's it.
And I'm like, okay. I mean, my parish, like the staff there is very on top of everything. So I didn't have to worry about like, oh, things checked off, you know, do they get their baptism prep? Any of that. Like I knew everything was fine. So like, great. From a priest or a cleric perspective, that's a great position to be in.
Just show up and pour that water.
Exactly. So I was like, great. So I had the earlier masses. I assisted at the early masses that day. And so I got in the sacristy to look at the baptism paperwork right before. And I was just reading the name. And the last name I recognized. I was like, is that? No. Well, I looked at the rest of the paperwork, and the parents are two friends of mine from college. Wow. And I was actually I altar served their wedding, which was here at the Basilica. It was on December 26th. They got married the day after Christmas, I think, or the 27th, either way. But I had no idea that they had moved out to the South Hills. And I hadn't seen them. I saw them, I think, a year after they got married, but I don't think I'd seen them since. And I didn't even know they had a second kid.
Ta-da!
And I was like, this is my first baptism. And I saw The Godfathers, another good friend of mine from college. I was like, what? This is so cool. So I put on, because of that, I put on like the nicest cope I could and like a gold cincture and everything. It was quite nice. So I come into the church and it's a bunch of people I know from school are all there, which was so. And so my friend Joe, who's the dad, he said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm doing the baptism. He goes, you are? Why are you here? And then his wife came up, Megan. She said, what? Like, aren't you supposed to be at St. Vincent? Like, well, I'm actually assigned here as the deacon. And so they were really excited. And it was just very special to kind of having seen and been, you know, right on the altar with them when they were married.
Yeah.
To then also being able to baptize their second kid was, yeah.
It's beautiful.
It was very, so that might be like probably my favorite thing so far as a deacon. But I don't know. I also, went to the Catholic Youth Summer Camp, Damascus, this past June. And being a deacon there, I was hot off the press. I was only like 3 weeks ordained at that point. And just one, being able to take like a different level of ministry, particularly with the Eucharist, so with like processions and exposition and benediction, was just, wow, like incredible. And the faith, if you know, some of you are listening and you're older and you think like the faith of the younger generation is dying, and maybe in some place it is, but go to this summer camp and you will be proven dead wrong. I have never seen high school kids. There was high school and middle schoolers there. I was mostly with the middle school, but I did some like benediction and adoration with the high school kids. I've never seen faith like that. The most profound witness of belief in Christ's presence in the Eucharist. And I think like if there was a favorite moment of my diaconate, it would be this. So in the newly published ritual book on worship of the Blessed Sacrament outside of Mass, it makes it very clear that personal benediction are not allowed. So if you don't know what that is, in the past, there used to be kind of a custom that people would like line up in a row and the priest would come by them with the monstrance and bless them individually. Just kind of like, you know, you would give someone a blessing individually. Well, this ritual book came out and said benediction is a communal rite. It is meant for the blessing of all people and is not to be a singular thing. So individuals are not to be blessed by the Eucharist themselves. So at Damascus, they kind of got around that by saying, okay, well, we'll do personal veneration. So the deacon or the priest isn't to bless them, but you can still bring the monstrance as close to the person as you want, right? There's nothing wrong with that. So what they did is we're in an auditorium, and the altar was up on the stage, and they would bring the kids up, the high school kids, about 40 at a time, and they would kneel all around the altar. And then we would take the monstrance one by one and stand in front of them for, I don't know, like 12 seconds while they prayed or maybe touch the monstrance and then would move on. And it was me, Father Francis, who's our vocation director, and then a Capuchin Franciscan from, I think he was from Illinois, who were the ones that were doing the veneration. And I mean, it's heavy when you hold it for long enough. And so we would switch off like every two rounds. So basically every 80 kids, we were switching off. And Father Francis had just finished with a group of kids. And when they were done, they were supposed to stand up and go sit down. Well, he had finished with this one girl and then passed it off to me. And I was starting, well, she didn't get up. And I was like five or six kids down the row. And I just heard a voice in my head that said, like, go back. She didn't get enough time. And I was like, that's crazy. Like, you know, there's like 200 more kids to go. Like, I don't have time to just go back every time I think maybe this kid needs more time. And then the other voice said, like, are you kidding me? Like, will you deprive someone? Like, will you deprive me of encountering? And will you deprive her of encountering me? And I was like, okay. So I went back. And as soon as I stood in front, she broke down and just started crying and just kept on saying, "Thank you for coming back, Jesus. Thank you for coming back, Jesus." And had nothing to do with me.
No.
Like, she wasn't thanking me. She was thanking Jesus for coming back. And like, I started crying because I'm like, wow, like this is what it means for someone to have a prayer of hope and then for that hope to be fulfilled. And Jesus is, you know, the fulfillment of all of our hope. So that, yeah, that moment,
wow,
stands pretty high, just a witness to me that God truly has desired for me to be a priest, mm-hmm. and also to be a deacon in this phase in our life, mm-hmm. you know, challenge, I mean, and I will maybe impatience, like I also want to be a priest now and we could talk about that, but I think, the challenge, like what you said, kind of the whiplash coming back. I think the thing is, feeling like my foot is in two places and I want both of my feet to be in one. Like I love my parish very deeply and I love the people there and the ministry I've had with the high school kids, with some of the families, some of the older people too at daily mass. And I just really want to stay there. I don't want to come back. And I want to be able to give more investment of my time. And I love preaching, but preaching is challenging. Mm-hmm. It's challenging when I don't get as much experience as I could if I stayed there the whole time, you know? So kind of feeling torn, I think, is a big mm-hmm. challenge. Like, where do I belong anywhere right now? I feel like I don't. I feel like I'm kind of in like three spots of seminary, monastery, and parish. And I would really like to just be in one for a little bit.
Yeah. I'm sure our Lord must have felt like that. Look where he came from.
Yeah, right.
He came down to here.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's, well, it's another thing that one professor said, we can use this to relate to married couples someday and engaged couples. Mm-hmm. You know, Catholic Church, our teaching, our morality is that we are to refrain from sexual relations before marriage. And this is going to teach us in a way to accompany engaged couples, those preparing for marriage, of, I just want to be married.
Yeah,
I want to have a family. I want to do this and this, but no, you're not called to that right now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of a clicking moment in my mind and prayer life of, yeah, like I can use this angst and anguish to help others someday. And that gives me a lot of peace, knowing that, you know, I can't relate to married couples as deeply as other married couples can, but I can say with confidence, I know what it's like to want something so badly, but I have to wait right now. I have to go through formation. I can see it in the distance, but I have to just bear with it right now.
Yeah.
And trust.
Yeah. Living in the present moment of it, you know, I mean, cause we have to, in some ways, plan ahead. Mm-hmm. Like we're buying some of our vestments,
oh, yeah,
or our chalices. I've been planning my first mass, which is Pentecost. And the temptation is to kind of cast everything ahead, right? And to be like, well, once I have that, then I'll be satisfied or fulfilled, or I'll really feel like I am doing what I'm supposed to. But that's to miss both what God can do in the moment, but also that he wants me to encounter people now as a deacon. Mm-hmm. Like if he wanted me to encounter people in my parish this year as a priest, he would have already made me a priest.
Mm-hmm.
And... so yeah, I don't. It's living in the present moment is not fun, and it's not easy, but it is necessary because, as C.S. Lewis says, it is only in the present that eternity touches reality, and I'm reminded of that a lot. But
and there's a healthy balance. I am very excited. I went to Chicago for fall break to, as I've told you about, ordering my vestments from the House of Hanson, papal tailor. Can say that now. I used the Pope's tailor in Chicago. Wow. It's also where Fulton Sheen had his Ferriola made, you know, the great big capes,
mm-hmm.
was House of Hanson, Chicago. And just designing it and seeing my vestment come alive, and having Jerry, the owner, say that, Tyler, this is a unique, I have never made this combination before.
Wow.
It's kind of it's a damask white fabric with crucifixion scenes tying to my devotion to Sorrowful Mother. And then a blue stripe right down the middle, like a deep, it's kind of a, it's like a royal Frenchish, It's a beautiful blue. It has crowns all down it. The whole shebang, dalmatics and chasuble and chalice veils, a cope and everything. And that's exciting. And my chalice is being worked on. Your chalice is done. You haven't seen it yet.
I have not seen it yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's these little, I'm not worshiping it as an idol. No. And I'm not ignoring the present. But these little motivations are just beautiful for me.
Yeah.
This is something I'm giving my life to and seeing it slowly, literally take shape. Just really, just little things to cling to. And we can check in next semester and see how that is going.
Yeah.
Middle of February and March, we're like,
help. Well, but to your like marriage analogy, it'd be like preparing for a wedding too, you know? Like it's the most, well, it isn't the most important day, but at the same time, it is the most important day.
We said yes to the dress.
Right. Yeah, right. That's true though. And it's not to say, oh, well, let's be married tomorrow, but rather like the, and kind of a joyful anticipation is also a really beautiful thing. And I very willingly, when people say like, are you excited to be a priest? I say, absolutely. Like, I would love to be ordained tomorrow. I know it's not what I'm going to be. And share with them like why I'm excited. I mean, the biggest thing, yes, the bells, the smells, the vestments, the chalice. My chalice is actually really, it's really special. So my great uncle was a priest for Syracuse, New York. So near-ish to you. And I have his, I believe it's his first chalice. And so kind of continuity of, you know, the familial priesthood. I got the chalice refurbished, and it will be the chalice I use for my first mass. And it has my great-grandmother, I believe, great-grandmother's engagement diamond embedded in it. It's got, in Latin, around the chalice, behold the blood of Christ. That takes away the sins of the world. So yeah, when the guy called, he said, this is going to be amazing. He said, do you know that these are real diamonds? I said, oh, I'm quite aware.
Wow.
But yeah, I'm super excited about that. But even more than that, honestly, I'm just excited to be able to just be someone people can come to for confession. Like just do confessions. I know we've had a lot of confession prep the last couple of weeks in seminary, and we'll have even more next semester. And some of the priests have told us like, yeah, it's kind of intimidating, honestly, to be in the confessional. And people will say things to you. They open their hearts to you. Like, you'll be shocked how honest people will be. And you might fumble at like, how do I respond to this person? Or how do I console them? Or how do I call them to something better? Whatever it is. Yet in all that, I just know I am really, I can truly say this, probably only still Catholic because of the sacrament of confession. And so to be able to just give back in the smallest way on the investment that has been given to me through mercy, I want to do so.
Yeah. I'm excited for confessions, petrified, trembling with fear, holy fear, but excited because I've had some rough confession encounters and experiences of just being grilled by the priest. Like, I'm here confessing sins. Why are you asking me and pulling in teeth to say, why'd I do that?
Yeah.
So I just want to, you know, sometimes even be called upon to do it literally, to embrace people with love and just tell and thank them for being there. The world, especially with young people, the world is telling you confession is useless. You shouldn't feel bad for anything you ever confess. I'm a good person. But no, they're coming to confession.
Yeah.
So we've been talking about this in class a lot of when are you supposed to deny absolution? Or when are you supposed to gently pry a little bit to get details? And as of right now, it may change, but I'll be more grateful that they're there.
Yeah. No, I agree. Like, yeah.
Them being there and confessing sin, that says a lot for me. And just to embrace them and thank them for being there. I intend to do that, to thank every person. Thank you for coming to confession.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Faith is shown through this.
Welcome back. No matter how long it's been, if it's been 3 days, welcome back. You know, you're no less received because you had to come back again, or you feel like you need to come back again, or 30 years, you're no less received. So, Well, in my last question, to get a little bit fun is, and I know you have one, this is why I'm asking. Like, let's hear a wild story of you being a deacon. I also have, I don't know if it's nearly as wild as yours, but I have a very entertaining story that happened about a month and a half ago.
So there was an event. I think this is what you're referring to. Yes.
These things we were told, like, oh, these will happen in seminary. Like, we'd run through like wild scenarios, and like, oh, this will never happen. Well, sometimes they do.
So there was a weekend. I call it my demon and helicopter weekend. Yes. There's a woman after mass. And she's thanking me for preaching and this and this and this. And oh, can you come bless my house? Can you come bless my house? And sure. Well, here's the bulletin. Why don't you give the parish office a call and I'll get back to you? Well, then she just launches this whole, oh, deacon, the demons. The demons in my house, the demons. She's like, the demons, they're everywhere. Okay, I need an exorcism. Oh, my house is full of demons. And I'm like, a blessing is a great place to start. Why don't I come bless your house? Okay, but the demons. So there's half the story. The same day that the following mass that later in the morning, a lady fell out of the car, getting out of the car in the parking lot, smacked her head, blood everywhere. It wasn't looking pretty. And the ambulance wasn't coming quick enough. The fire trucks were delayed. Parishioners were in the street on their phones, all, where is the ambulance? Where is the ambulance? Well, we had to start mass. I mean, it's time to start mass. So we begin the mass. And I'm sitting there, and the doors of the church are all glass. So I can just see, like, zoom, ambulance, zoom, ambulance. And all of a sudden, you hear, they landed a helicopter behind the church,
That's
and they
so
life
crazy.
flighted her. To a hospital. And then, yeah, so I'm preaching the homily while this is happening, trying to, like, knowing that people are in the pews, they have no idea what's going on. They don't know this lady fell. I'm like, I am so distracted right now, Lord, but
Oh.
thank God this is my fourth time preaching this homily because I have it pretty much
Right.
memorized. I was so spaced out.
Oh man.
And it's a reality of what do you do as a priest when there's like a serious issue. Like I think every priest has a story of someone fainting at a funeral, or a priest, or someone in general fainting in the hot summer. I know a couple of priests that have people die at funerals. They just like drop dead. Like
Wow,
you're up there celebrating the mass, offering the prayers, and like, what do you do? And like stay focused and not get everyone in a frantic, a tizzy. That is my demon and helicopter weekend story. I had a great nap after all that.
No kidding.
I had a great nap. They didn't teach this in seminary. That
No.
was that's my textbook. They don't teach this in seminary.
Well, my textbook one is what I call the four horse story. So, this was at the very, very beginning of my 2 week practicum at the parish. My pastor, or I think it was my secretary, stopped me and said, "Hey, we got a call from, this woman who they're bringing her mom to be buried in the huge cemetery out in the South Hills, Queen of Heaven Cemetery. But they're coming in from a distance because the funeral mass was where I guess her mom had been living recently, which was like over an hour away. But they wanted her buried at Queen of Heaven because that's, I guess, where her husband had been buried. So the pastor of that parish didn't want to, drive the hour plus and then back to do the burial and the committal rite. So they asked us to do it, and then my pastor said, "Well, what you need some experience. Deacons can do committal rites, so why don't you do it?" I'm like, "Okay, great." So I have the funeral home's number, and they're supposed to be at the cemetery at 1. So I got there 12:45, and there's only one way in. So I just was in the parking lot right. There's a mausoleum as soon as you come in. I was in the mausoleum parking lot, just ready for the funeral procession to come in. Well, I get a call from them that says, "Hey, we hit like some construction traffic, so it's gonna be like another 15 minutes." I'm like, "Okay, that's fine. I'm here." So around 1:10-ish, a little before that, funeral procession rolls in. I'm like, okay, I guess they probably got a little ahead of time than they were expecting. Well, then they pulled in, and they pulled into the mausoleum. And I was a little confused. I'm like, oh, I thought I was doing this at the gravesite, but maybe I just got the info wrong, and they're from an hour away, so maybe like the secretary heard it wrong, whatever. So I got out of my car. I went to the sidewalk and was greeting people as they're coming in. And I was like, I'm sorry for your loss. And I went and asked the funeral director, like, oh, remind me of the name of the deceased. And she just looked at me. And the funeral director that I talked to on the phone was a woman too. So that a woman came out just made sense to me. I was like, and she said, it's like Rose Marie or something like that. And I forgot that I had a slip with the like deceased name, but it had fallen out of my ritual book. So I was like, oh, well, I knew it was a woman. So like, okay. Oh, so I'm like there and I like have my holy water and everything ready. And people are looking at me like, why are you here? But I just figured like, I'm going to have it, you know. Well, then a priest gets out and starts walking. And he just looks at me and I realized, ha, I'm at the wrong committal. So I'm like, and I said out loud, oh my gosh, am I at the wrong like funeral? And then these people, I turn around, there's people behind me and they just kind of look at me like, are you crazy? I'm like, oh, okay. So I get in my car and then a funeral procession starts pulling in. I'm like, okay, there it is. So I get in the driveway ready to pull in behind the funeral procession. But as I'm waiting, a third hearse comes right behind them. And now I don't know which one's which. And they both start heading towards the cemetery. So I roll in behind, and when they get up, and we get to a fork in the road, and this is a massive cemetery. It's really big. And they both go different directions. I'm like, oh man, I don't even remember the name of the funeral home at this point to like figure out which one's which. And then what do I see in my rearview mirror? A fourth. Like, there's no way. There is no way this is real. But I just decided to kind of like just go for it. And went with the first funeral procession that I saw. And I hightailed it up the hill, and I got a call from them. They're like, Deacon Francisco, we're at the gravesite. Where are you? And I'm like, well, a couple other processions came in, so I hope I'm at the right one. I'm like, do you have orange flags? And like, yeah, we're like Bochner Funeral Home or whatever. I'm like, I want to be like, I don't remember, all right? I don't know. I'm not from around here. So it turned out to be the right one.
Wow.
Thank God. And I did the funeral, the committal, and it was very nice. But yeah, they did not prepare for that in seminary.
No, we didn't have that in deacon prep.
And as it turned out, so this particular cemetery like cranks out committals. They're on a schedule for every like 15 or 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So what happened was the one that came at 1:10 was also supposed to be there at 1. And so they were late. Then the one I had was late. The third one came was on time, and the fourth one came was early.
You can't make this up.
And yeah, it was just wild. So yeah, that's my favorite story. It was very entertaining. But wow.
I was at the cemetery once during my practicum as well. Didn't have that much of an issue. We rode with the funeral director.
Yeah, that helps. That's smart. Yeah, after that, that's what I started doing. I'm like, yeah, I'll go in the lead car. Yeah, I don't
want to. I've never seen a continuous flow.
It's crazy.
Of hearses. Like, it was Brave New World.
It was like that national cemetery, but not.
It's impressive. Every 15 minutes, there's a hearse coming in.
Yeah. Wow. So, anyways, that's a little bit of a snapshot into our first 6 months as a deacon. Maybe we'll circle back in a little over 6 months to see what new priesthood looks like.
New priesthood.
Wow. That's so crazy that now it's months away. It's always been years, and now it's months.
Yeah, the fact that I didn't realize that it's been about 6 months. Our 6 month anniversary is coming soon. Yeah. So the time that's elapsed since my ordination, that's what it is before my priesthood at this point. Like, that's...
Get ready, folks. Wow. The existential crises are coming. Anyways. Well... Fitz, I appreciate you being here and sharing the stories. And thank you all for watching another episode of the All Good in the Brotherhood podcast, the podcast of the Benedict Project. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a comment below on what you liked. And if you have any questions about other things about being a deacon or about a vocation to the priesthood and monastic life, feel free to drop those. If you think there's someone who would enjoy this episode, give it a share. Like and subscribe, because I'm not begging, but I would invite you to do so, to continue to grow the channel and the mission of the Benedict Project. If you want to hear more about like even the moments of becoming a deacon, you can check out this podcast episode where I talk about my particular ordination. And if you want to know what it's like to, you know, be a monk around this time of year as we celebrate Thanksgiving, you can check out this episode where I talk about, the Thanksgiving celebration in the monastery. So I hope you all have a wonderful day. Thank you again, hey, Tyler.
Thanks.
And God bless you all.